Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. U.S. media is in a near constant panic about China. China's cracking down on private education, on carbon emissions, on big tech, on billionaires. No, please, not the billionaires. The cold warriors in the U.S. government and media call these moves authoritarian, leftward tyranny, and bad for business, while Chinese President Xi Jinping calls it common prosperity to create a more equitable society on the road to building socialism. Here to help us understand the Chinese point of view is Tings Chak, a member of the Dengsheng News Collective and a researcher at the Tricontinental Institute. Tings, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rania.
It's great to have you back on. And before we get started, I just want to give a quick reminder to those who are watching. You can listen to every episode of the show, Rania Kalik Dispatches, anywhere you get podcasts. And for those who are listening, you can watch every episode of this show on the Breakthrough News YouTube page. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. So Tings, let's just jump right into it. I guess the best place to start is maybe defining common prosperity. So can you tell our listeners and viewers, what is common prosperity? And why do you think the U.S. is so alarmed by it and calls it a crackdown?
Okay, this is a big question, but I'll try to be brief. I think common prosperity, we can look at it in two angles. One is the aspect that it's more of a vision. And the other is a set of reforms that are happening. So in terms of common prosperity as a vision, it has a long history in, you know, Chinese philosophy, Chinese history and politics about what this means. But let's just say in the socialist period, since the creation of the People's Republic of China, we've heard this term being used by previous leaders like Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping to talk about common prosperity as really just the goal of developing the society of China so that the livelihoods of people and the productive forces are developed at the same time. So even when we're looking at the reform opening up period under Deng, the goal to kind of rapidly expand and integrate into the international market as quickly as possible always had common prosperity as the ultimate end. You know, livelihoods was at the end of it. But at the same time, during that period, many contradictions emerged. Inequality increased. We have, you know, the cost to the environment. We have inequality not only actually between the rich and the poor, but also between regions. You know, we have more developed regions than compared to, you know, the western and central areas, between the rural and urban. And also, you know, we've seen increases like skyrocketing prices of the basic many basic things, especially in the urban centers, like housing and education and healthcare. So those aspects have led to, let's say, the second part, which is a series of reforms that are aiming to address that aspect of common prosperity. And so recently, really initiated in this year, is the government's attempt to balance this need to clearly increase economic development and efficiency, but at the same time, look at how the welfare mechanisms can be strengthened. So it takes the form of, you know, actually looking at income distribution. What are the ways that income is being distributed? And how does that need to be reformed? And there's huge debates going on right now, basically anticipating what the tax reform will look like, whether it be the real estate taxes, inheritance taxes, income taxes. Exactly. You know, the big bad word. I was like, what will be the percentage? How much will they take away from the rich? Yeah. And then also like other things like Social Security, how to provide more public housing, public education, and strengthen public health care. And so the Western freakout is in this area of like, okay, now they're cracking down, which is now they're cracking down on real estate, cracking down on private tutoring, cracking down on entertainment, big tech, all the rest. And one of the aspects, I think, just to kind of dispel the, you know, anxieties a little bit, is that China is not ending with, you know, capitalists or capital. You know, very much is still in the stage of development that it requires private capital and private capitalists. Mm-hmm. But what it is trying to do is actually trying to mediate the unruly, or what they call the disorderly rise of capital expansion. And so that can redirect some of that more towards national interests and interests of developing people's livelihoods. So that's where I think I want to calm people in the West. It's like, no, capitalists have not been all run out of the country. It's just, you know, they're kind of reeling the excesses a bit there.
Yeah, which is like the opposite of what we're doing in the US, for example. And I guess a good place to maybe segue here is how this common prosperity, which has been described in a lot of US media as like a return to their roots or something. They're like, they're returning to their communist roots. That's what we keep seeing. But so there's a lot of like Red Scare embedded in all this. But how is this common prosperity being implemented in the context of education, which is something that you've covered?
So I think education is interesting because that's one of the probably biggest shocks that came in at the end of July of this year is when the government announced an overhaul of specifically one sector of education, which is the private tutoring industry. And I think for a lot of listeners, they might be surprised why private tutoring. It's very specific. Mm-hmm. So it's actually just explain what that looks like. It's the extracurricular courses that were initially, these are private, initially created so that, you know, help some students in need to sort of catch up with their school curriculum. But over the years has grown into a really massive industry to help kids, especially kids coming from families that can afford it, to get ahead of the school curriculum. And I just want to also mention that China's education system is one that's extremely competitive, you know, mm-hmm. In terms of highly test-oriented. Huge stresses are being put on young people and also families so that they can get into the top universities and all that. So the government actually came in and implemented what's called a double reduction policy, which is looking at simultaneously decreasing the pressures on students in the schools, but also the financial burdens on parents, especially in this private education system. And so what we've seen is actually a huge scaling back of this private industry. And just to get a sense how big it had gotten over the last 20 years, I mean, it just emerged in around the 1990s when it became liberalized and could get international investment in it. For example, the first private tutoring company was listed on the New York Stock Exchange in 2006. So it's still relatively recent. But in the last 15, 20 years, that has ballooned to an industry of almost $150 billion. And with over 300 million students in China enrolled. So it is, I liked how the wording of the Ministry of Education here led the ministry to call the sector hijacked by capital. So this, you know, policy was really coming in and saying, okay, enough with profiting off of the education sector, off of these students' anxieties, parents' anxieties, which obviously there's a litany. I don't even probably need to explain the many kinds of abuses that some of these companies had in terms of trying to lure in families that are just pretty anxious to get their schools ahead, their students ahead. And then so the rule is actually not that shocking. It's just saying that this industry should not be for profit. This industry should not have foreign funding or shouldn't be listed on stock exchanges. Also regulating some things about, on holidays and weekends, they shouldn't be teaching these core courses. So we've actually seen since then some interesting improvements in how this is addressing what is called education inequality, because ultimately common prosperity, one of the aspects is education, is if some people can kind of get ahead through the secondary stream, it's going to weaken the resources in the public sector. So this is happening at the same time that other aspects of, you know, more funding into the public education system, higher salaries per public education teachers, and also reducing things like the amount of mandatory tests, or, you know, this practice of posting the tests and the rankings of the tests at the schools, which is like hugely stressful for students. Yeah. And making you know, other things like sports and arts education more of a priority than just, you know, cramming. And so cracking down, and it is a crackdown, a positive crackdown, let's say, on the private tutoring industry that was totally preying on this on young people and their parents, actually an advancement for people here.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds incredible. And again, it's so interesting how this is like the opposite of what's happening in the US, like the polar opposite, where it's like everything's becoming more privatized, public education is being like defunded, and this has been the trajectory for the past 20 years. But, you know, how does this feed into the issue of the crackdown on billionaires, which is what you see a lot of headlines about in US media, is that China's cracking down on billionaires and therefore cracking down on like success. What are they talking about when they say that?
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, one of the aspects of you know, the rapid economic development is trying to create a lot of billionaires. And so in a way, billionaires have been affected in this round of reforms. And I would say like maybe in a few ways. One is this in the common prosperity kind of, let's say, policy. One of the aspects is what's called the third distribution. And looking at how to redistribute wealth, not necessarily through the taxation means, but also encouraging rich people and private companies to contribute back. So this is philanthropy, it's donations. And we've actually seen one after another, these big tech firms, many of them, including like Alibaba, have already gotten hit by these anti-monopoly practices, gotten big fines. Alibaba got $2.8 billion in fines. And soon after came out and said, okay, I'm going to donate $15.5 billion to Common Prosperity. And we've seen that billionaires lining up, huge celebrities, big tech firms waiting to basically say, okay, we will also pay back. People are framing it as a kind of Robin Hood, but, you know, many of these stay very wealthy billionaires, so you don't have to worry about that.
there's still some billionaires, guys.
Yeah, there's still billionaires. It's just bringing a little bit of, like, Trump change for them. But there's also some other ways that they've been sort of, I won't say hit, you know, and in some ways by these policies is, let's say, the education reform. So some of these private tutoring company CEOs have gone very rich, exactly off the backs of, you know, the students' pressures and everything. So one of the companies, the first one that was listed on the New York Stock Exchange that I mentioned, New Oriental, the owner, the founder, actually saw his own personal wealth decrease by 70%. Since April this year.
That's
still
so
pretty rich. That's actually an interesting story because he came out like just a week or two ago and basically said he is now redirecting his entire industry, which like his company has 1,500 schools. Like it's that big.
Whoa.
He said he's going to turn all of them towards, because they closed the running of the normal schools that they were doing, and they're going to turn them towards selling agricultural products and helping peasants. And also donating all their school furniture to school to rural schools, and also help getting the teachers to help with like live streaming of selling agricultural products, support rural development. So he's also turning around his view, but he's a businessman, so he also knows where the opportunities are and how to stay in line. But then also once in a while, you'll see these cases that make headlines is that there's also big, you know, the government's taking corruption really seriously. And so you'll see also some of the CEOs or founders or high level executives are also, you know, getting caught up in the anti-corruption cases. And, you know, that's a good thing.
I mean,
if there is corruption, it's good that it's being taken care of.
Right. And it's also so fun. I mean, I don't know if we're going to end up doing this with every topic that we touch on this, but it's like, I wish these kinds of things were happening in the US, where again, it's like the polar opposite. And you just have all these billionaires, you know, not only controlling government, but they are, it's like, even if they gave away like 90% of their wealth, I think a lot of them would still be billionaires. And I mean, it's all just so they can, like, it's, we're not even talking about third vacation homes here. We're talking about like these people have more money than like entire GDPs of certain countries. Like it's completely outrageous. So it's amazing what's taking place. And then the other issue that this feeds into too is the issue of big tech, which I think is the one that I've seen, you know, when I read headlines about what China's doing domestically, this is one of the things that's like red alert, China's going after big tech. So can you talk a little bit about what the going after big tech means and why that's actually like a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, big tech, I think, is probably one of the concerns that is across the board, right? I mean, And in here, we've been seeing a crackdown. It's interesting that I think Western media can get really freaked out, even though a lot of people would probably support the kind of unbridled expansion and of big tech companies that aren't beholden to anyone. I mean, I think we can trace it back. The big headline was around when Jack Ma's Ant Group, which is affiliated with Alibaba, was about to do the largest IPO, initial public offering, on the Shanghai and Hong Kong stock exchanges last year. It was going to be the largest in the history of capitalism, like the largest, some almost $40 billion. So it was one of those historic events about to happen. And just a couple of weeks before that, the government comes in and say, just wait a second. We want to check in some of your audit, some things here. But I mean, what were some of the areas, you know, they're concerned with? Is obviously there were, you know, it's under the framework of monopolistic practices. And a lot of these tech companies have grown into sizes where they are unchallenged in the areas and adopt practices that are not good for users. They're not good for workers. They're not good for the rest of society. But then there was also other aspects, you know, where especially these companies, they're such mega platforms that they start branching into areas. And for Ant Group or Ant Financial, they were going into the sector of, you know, micro lending, financial services, that they were really becoming to be act like a bank without having to follow the rules of the bank. And that is really a red line here. The banks are quite tightly controlled. They're state owned. And so that is not an area that a private company can just say that I can go into and change the rules of an industry that you are not a part of. And then another part is a big part is data. You know, the question of who owns data, how data is used, how it gets processed. All of that, I mean, is like of an kind of utmost urgency everywhere we go. And of course, Ant Group and its, what's it called, the transaction payment app, Alipay, actually annually transacts more money than the GDP of China. It's a huge amount of money that they're circulating. And it means that every single purchase that is made, they have the data on that, you know, what people are looking for, what they're searching for, what they want. So that kind of stuff right now, the government is going through big conversations about treating that as a public good. And I actually think that's quite an interesting debate. Like, data isn't something that should be just in the hands of the private companies because it is, I mean, a public good. And so there's a huge amount of interesting debate about how data should be treated, who should own it, who should manage it, and how the government should come in. And so that is part of it. And we just saw actually earlier this month, as a part of this sort of big tech series of reforms, is what is called the Personal Information Protection Law. That is starting to look at how users can also, you know, if you're on your phone, have a bit more rights about controlling when you give your info. I mean, anyone who uses cell phone, whatever apps that there are, you basically are signing away, I don't know, your grandchildren's freedom, and you don't even know it, you know? Right. And so they're really looking into that aspect now because, you know, how data is going to be controlled is at most, like, you know, a very important question of our time. And I'll just add another point here is that another aspect on big tech is how workers are being treated. You know, this whole gig economy thing means that more and more people in China are opting to work in gig economy because the wages are better. But there's also a pretty nasty work culture. And here it's called 996. You know, it's working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. And that's a highly encouraged work culture, especially in the big tech sector. I mean, one of the, you know, Jack Ma was, you know, infamous for saying, oh, workers should feel blessed for basically being exploited to work 996. You know, we don't want people who comfortably work 40 hours a week. So there is also that, let's say, a kind of arrogance in the big tech sector that was also bad for the workers. And so this is also coming with a series of reforms and encouragement by the government, say 996 is something that, like, is pretty endemic in that industry and needs to be addressed. I mean, it's not something we can agree with at all.
Yeah. And I'll just say, like, as somebody, I'm kind of a workaholic, but I also hate working. I think 40 hours is too much. That said, I mean, my job isn't really
996 sounds okay, actually.
Well, I mean, that's kind of actually probably how much I do end up working. But I mean, I don't, my job doesn't really feel like work because it's like, you know, I feel like I'm a lucky person. I get to do something that I really enjoy doing. It's like also something that like is leisurely for me, not like in a coal mine or anything like that, or at a big tech firm. I can't even imagine like having to spend my, that's crazy, like 12 hours a day, 9 to 9. And that, I mean, that's also amazing that what's happening in response to that. And I guess one good way, like one good place to take this is, you know, these policies were told by the leadership in China that it's part of building socialism. So can you explain that a little bit? Like, how is this all part of, this isn't just random policies that are happening from like different sections of society. It's coming from one place for a reason. And it's to, you know, move towards this path on the road on, so, or the road to socialism. So can you explain how that works?
I mean, I think, you know, going just back to the beginning of the show when we were talking about common prosperity and this whole concept, I mean, it was always, I guess, helping us remember the process of socialist construction. I think there's always, you know, when those who, you know, like to criticize, oh, socialist countries or countries that are constructing socialism are bad in this and that way, without ever having attempted to try to actually build a socialist society, and think it's sort of something that comes right out of a box, ready made. But it hasn't. And it is actually a long, multi-generational process to build a society where the fruits of the labor can be shared among those who produce it. But that being said, the process of Chinese socialist construction has been that emerging out of this rapid economic phase in the reform opening up period led by Deng Xiaoping, the question he even had back in 1978 when that began was that warning against extreme polarization in the country. In particular, was this question of inequality. So now at this phase where, you know, China has experienced, you know, incredible amount of economic growth that's ever happened in history and sustained over many years, it's been able to uplift 850 million people out of poverty, extreme poverty, and essentially eradicate extreme poverty from a country of 1.4 billion, which we spoke at length with about last time, is a part of this improving the well-being of people at the same time of elevating the productive forces and the economy of the country. This is part of socialist construction. You can't get ahead of your time in order to reach that level. And so right now, when we look at, you know, whether we want to call them crackdowns or whatever, but the reeling in of the excess of the private industries and the private capital and the strengthening of the public sectors of the government and the increasing the regulations of these new industries that were non-existent, of course, in the 1970s and 80s, is part of this process of what is socialist construction. And I think actually on the data question, just a little tidbit that I thought was quite interesting is there's been a recent debate and a recent inclusion of looking at data now as being considered one of the five productive factors of society. So we have, you know, other aspects, which is like land, labor, technology, and capital. But now data is considered that. Data is actually now one of the types of how we think about the digital economy. Who produces data, who manages data is also part of the production of society. Anyways, that's a bit of a side note. I just thought that was quite interesting. But all to say is that this is, I think, this is part of a process, and common prosperity is, in a way, a logical next step to this poverty eradication process. You know, that's not the end goal to eradicate extreme poverty. It's actually to make sure that everyone lives well.
And that's a good, I mean, I want to let everybody who's listening and watching know you actually wrote an excellent report on what you just mentioned, which is China's eradication of extreme poverty, lifting 850 million people out of extreme poverty, which is huge. You wrote a report about that for Tricontinental, and we did an interview about it a few months ago, which I recommend people go check out on the Breakthrough News channel. And yeah, that's interesting. You put that in the context of the sort of building on the elimination of poverty. I'm also curious how climate change fits into this, because we just had the COP26 and we heard Joe Biden try to displace blame for climate change caused disproportionately by the former colonial powers. He tried to place that blame on Russia and specifically China. And the U.S. media often tries to, you know, play with the numbers to actually blame China for being like the biggest carbon emitter without giving any context to where that number is coming from. The fact that China also has over a billion people and is like the world's manufacturing hub. But I'm curious, you know, how is China confronting the climate issue, and is socialism and common prosperity a part of that?
I think the climate question is a big one. And I know that the recent COPs, we, you know, have heard many kinds of the debates, and there's a lot of villainization of China and China's role. And one of the things I think, and also President Xi made some speech, a speech about this, is looking at what is the historical and current responsibilities of the developed world in comparison with the developing world. I think it's interesting, and your listeners will know really well that this is the history of the Global South, is that very much the wealth of the Global North and the advanced capitalist countries has been off of backs of the exploited labor and land of the colonized world. So that industrialization and development couldn't have happened if it wasn't off the blood, sweat, and tears, and also environmental pollution of the South. And so this kind of perpetual underdevelopment of the South meant that, you know, the air is here, the air here is polluted, the waters are more polluted, and that that kind of let's say industrialization or environmental pollution could be exported to other countries. So mm-hmm. I think in terms of, you know, there's always a question, is China really a developing country? You know, I mean, according to the UN, it's a developing country. According to the metrics, it is. It is emerging soon in the next years into a high income economy. But I think one thing on the climate aspect that helps us remind us that China is a developing country is the stage of development it's at. So mm-hmm. for example, Europe actually reached its emissions peak in 1979, like decades ago. China still actually hasn't peaked, and it's hoping to reach its peak, or has projected to reach its peak before 2030. Just that fact alone helps us understand a little bit the stage of industrialization and growth that the countries are in. Yet, China has just last year made a commitment to reach 2060 carbon neutrality, and Europe is 2050. I mean, just to say that these countries, comparing, I mean, Europe is a continent, but that these economies have developed for so much longer, industrialized for so much longer, and been able to export its the dirtiest of its manufacturing industries to the South, but yet hasn't actually made any big commitments for the world or itself in terms of carbon neutrality. And this question around, China is the biggest emitter, and you raise a really good point. It's that it doesn't put it into perspective. China produces almost 30% of the goods, and actually I've just forgotten the number now, but it's a higher percent or more or less around the same of all the consumer goods in the U.S. and then also the world. So we have to actually realize that what the China's emissions are also in a way shared with the rest of the world. This comes at all levels. You know, it's not just the sort of the cheaper products that China produces, but also now in the higher technological goods. I mean, one example, I can give a whole big list, but one of them is last year's cell phones. 88% of them were produced in China. So everyone here might be watching something off their cell phone. And this is also multiplied with computers and other technologies, TVs, et cetera. So pretty much likelihood, if anyone's watching this, you're watching on something made in China. And so all of that kind of externalities, especially for the environment, is also something that is born by the people in China as well, right? And I always think, you know, to become the factory of the world that China became, the working class of China has actually paid twice, you know, in its labor, but also in the environment. And I always find it kind of ironic and almost a little bit cruel that in a lot of the mainstream media, we see a lot of shaming of China or Chinese people for, you know, suffering air pollution. You know, we see those images of the smoggy days in Beijing or polluted rivers and whatnot. And it's like, it's this is from producing goods for the rest that the rest of the world enjoys. And so that, I think it helps put us in context, but also just the question of China is the biggest emitter is not true when you come to per capita emissions. I mean, it's right. by all standards, it's about half of what the average person in the US produces. And it's not producing 30% of the goods for the world.
No. And also just consuming and throwing away. Yeah. Just consuming and then throwing away, basically.
And also just to raise the point, historically, the idea of cumulative emissions since industrialization, you know, there's different types of statistics out there since the mid 18th century. It's by far a small contributor compared to the, you know, the US or other advanced economies. So there's just so many aspects of that. That is just the sort of untruth about China as just being the big bad polluter only, right? Why is that is the question.
You know, I know I've asked you this question before, and I feel like I always ask it, but, and you don't have to go too in depth because we've answered it before, but I feel like it's always important because there's always this one person or like these five people who will be like, ew, but China's capitalist. Like, because China produces and manufactures, and it's like so integral to this global capitalist economy. So how on earth could you say that China's socialist or on the road to socialism? So how do you respond to that? Which I'm sure that you get a lot too. It's like, how can China be socialist if it's so intertwined with America's capitalist economy, for example?
I mean, no, this is always one of the eternal questions. I mean, first of all, I think kind of a similar point I made earlier, you know, there's always this expectation and the critics of socialist countries will always, always say, oh, but that's a socialist because, oh, there's capitalists or there's private capitalists. Like, who said, I mean, Marx didn't say that all of a sudden you just transition from like, here's revolution and then no more private capital. It just doesn't work like that. We still live in a capitalist world run by, you know, US hegemony. So it's not that easy. But I mean, I guess maybe I can break it down in some more kind of grounded ways. Is that, you know, if we ask the question, does private capital, do capitalists exist in China? Yes. And it forms a big part of the economy. And this is part of the reform and opening up period, is that recognizing that, yes, there were social and economic gains, incredible ones, during the Mao period, but the country was still very poor and extremely isolated. You know, at that point, it had been basically sanctioned since its existence, you know. So in terms of rapprochement with the U.S. and opening up to the world market was part of a strategy to develop socialism in the sense that, okay, we're still really behind technologically. Our industrial capacity is still really behind. We need to catch up. In order to do that, we still live in a capitalist world with imperialism. So we need to break the isolation. That means accessing, you know, markets, accessing capital so that you can actually finance projects and also know-how, you know. So it means sending people all around the world to study and get the knowledge and develop scientists, develop, you know, your technological and information sectors. Everything of that, you know, just to basically develop the productive means of the country. And in that period, there was also a reintroduction of a capitalist class. It does exist here, which had been pretty much, you know, became non-existent during the early socialist period. But it was part of the strategic national plan and say, okay, we need to reintroduce it, but how do we reintroduce it is the way. And so the policy was under this, keep the big and let go of the small, meaning that the very strategic sectors remain in the hands of the state in terms of the government. But the smaller area, smaller sectors, we can begin to reintroduce private capital to stimulate innovation, you know, development, and encourage that. But it was very much a kind of a planned or intentional way of looking at how of capitalist elements or capital would be reintroduced. And I would recommend for anyone who wants to learn about this, a book that just came out by 1804 Books in New York called China's Great Road by John Ross, who is a British economist, writes a lot about this period of understanding how the opening up reform period is in line with the development of socialism. And I just want to add two more elements in helping us understand why we cannot say China is capitalist. One is just land. And we, you know, this great Egyptian Marxist economist, Amir Amin, just a few years before he passed away in 2018, he actually wrote about this question in China. And he kind of put it quite kind of simply and easy to understand is that for him, the fact that the land is still in public hands, it makes it impossible to characterize China as being capitalist because, I mean, capitalist society is based on this, you know, this value, this principle of private property and private property as being a commodity. Here, it's still in public hands, even though there is real estate in terms of the use of the land and the leasing of the land. And I would say the kind of third point it's important to recognize why China, you can't characterize China as being capitalist, is that do capitalists dictate politics? And to this, it's a simple no. You know, very much capital is submitted to politics. That's what we're seeing. Why the West is freaking out about, oh my God, they're cracking down on capitalists, because they're not in power. You know, there's this interesting, he's a venture capitalist, but named Eric Lee, and he gave an actually interesting TED talk about understanding the system of governance here. I would recommend that too. But he once had an interview with RT, and he said, in China we have capitalists, but not capitalism. I'm a capitalist, but I have no power. I mean, it sounds a bit simplistic, but I mean, we're seeing this, the way that, you know, big tech, private industry, private tutoring, fintech, all these areas are being controlled, is actually saying the government and the CPC has power over of capital and how it's developed, and ultimately capital is submitted to politics.
Yeah, I think that's a really well said, and I love the Samir Amin name drop. He's one of my favorites. And, you know, I think it's also important to note, like, I think the most important point is what you say is, like, who controls politics? And, I mean, there's no question, like, when you look at the U.S., there's no question who controls politics. It's literally capital. It's capitalists. They control everything they decide. They fund the politicians who get to run. I think there's even been studies in the U.S. that show, like, that actual average people don't really have any impact whatsoever on policy. They don't have any say. It's literally the people with money. So that makes a huge difference in how you describe, or like how you describe your system and the characteristics that it has. But, you know, I want to move to just kind of like a more basic question, which is, Americans are they're surrounded, like you can't get away from it, with just anti-China propaganda. Because U.S. media personalities and politicians just like constantly, relentlessly are demonizing China, especially the way they describe it. They describe China as like this dystopian surveillance tyranny that's becoming increasingly authoritarian. And you have to be scared of this because it's a rising country. And it's going to somehow export this tyrannical system around the world, which we don't see any evidence of at all. But regardless, this is a common talking point that sits with Americans. Like, Americans absorb it. They hear it, they absorb it, and they start to believe it. You know, I, of course, don't buy into this. But like I said, it sticks in a lot of people's minds. So as someone who lives in China, can you just, you know, very briefly respond to how you see the reality on the ground and how that compares to this really cartoonish depiction we get of China in the US?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question. It's a big one. I mean, I guess tell some stories about what it looks like. One of the things, I mean, I'll use an example, because when I moved back to China right after, at the tail end of the pandemic. So it was kind of more or less controlled here. But one of the things I think this story really became kind of really exaggerated and elevated to international level was like the crackdown during COVID, you know, mm-hmm. and how the kind of social control mechanisms were put in place. And I guess I can just talk about my experience. I wasn't here during the roughest time of it, but how I've seen, I guess, the surveillance system, or let's call it the government system of I don't know, running a society of 1.4 billion people, and you need systems and you need technologies and all that. But one of the things I've actually tried to explain to people who aren't here is I've read actually articles about this. People are like, oh my God, you guys have a green code system that you have to scan your phone wherever you go. And it's like, you know, and I actually had the experience when I left for Brazil last year, where it's like sort of my second home. And when I, after living in China for some time and going there, I had been so, you know, accustomed to actually having a presence of the state caring about where you go, And have you been in a high risk area? If you're in quarantine, these are the things you need to do. Have you gotten tested? Is there a national system where your test can go so it's easy to check? You know, all those kinds of stuff. When I arrived in Brazil, you know, I got all my tests done and I'm ready to show my codes. And it's just like, welcome. You can walk right in. And that at that time, there were 2,000 deaths a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just thinking, I'm like, is this the... I feel a lack of the surveillance then, you know, I can actually just walk around without a mask and enter a bar or, you know, hang around with all kinds of loved ones or strangers and no one will ever know. And if I have
you can cough on everyone, you can lick the tabletops and like.
Exactly. So I feel like it's just my individual will of like whether I feel like doing something or not. Like, I don't know. I don't know what kind of society we want to build, but I think one where there is a little bit of collective responsibility and a little bit of management and facilitation by the state. So it's essential. And I'll just say the other day, I went to Beijing, which, you know, there were some recent cases and just a few cases will bring, you know, the status to like a medium level security. And I went there and I was with my partner. And we were just like, oh, because Shanghai's so easy, go there and you have to scan when you go into taxi, you have to scan when you go into mall, you scan into when you go into a hotel or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is kind of annoying. And then afterwards I realized, I'm like, this is such a smart system. Yeah. It means that if I scan when I go into Didi, which is the equivalent of an Uber, that means that anyone else riding that specific car with that specific driver will now be easily like reached out to because we had scanned entering that specific vehicle, not just that I entered Beijing as a city. I'm like that in terms of helping, you know, the city return back to normal if there was to be an outbreak, to help people's lives not be as interrupted, to not have to do a massive lockdown, but actually just located in small areas. That actually, to me, that kind of surveillance is actually really good for public health management. And yeah. And so, I mean, I would just say that as a kind of example of how that can be distorted and twisted into like, wow, I'm so oppressed by the green code that I have on my cell phone. When actually this is about managing a global pandemic, you know,
and the numbers don't lie.
That for the year yeah. and a half, I feel guilty that I've been living pretty much a normal life, except for having to do some tests when I travel between places and then, you know, having a green code following me around.
Where it's like, yeah, the numbers don't lie. I mean, you look at the numbers in China and then you look at the numbers in the, you know, as we call them, open countries, right? Where like, it's just everybody does whatever they want on an individual level and there's like no limits to it. And the numbers are striking. I mean, in the US still today, it's like become normal that 1,000 people die a day. I'm not sure what the number is today, but like, I remember like a month or so ago, I was seeing, I didn't even realize 1,000 people, over 1,000 people in the US were still dying a day. And it's just become totally normal and acceptable. And that definitely speaks to not being taken care of in any way by your government.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, I remember at some point in the U.S., it I think arrived at over 4,000 cases or even 5,000 cases. Oh, I mean, not cases, deaths a day.
Deaths.
That is the entire duration of what the pandemic, and 5,000 deaths is a lot. That's per day. That's entire, you know.
And it was preventable. It was preventable. Just nothing was being done to prevent it. Minimal efforts were being made to prevent it.
So I mean, that kind of, what is the authoritarianism and sort of what is the freedom that we're fighting for or supposedly fighting for? I mean, to me, human life, survival and well-being and safety, like these are essential things. And I have to say, walking around in China every day, I feel safe. Like yeah. from, you know, with my health protected because there's a kind of national system that's being, you know, helping manage a global crisis, you know?
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I actually, because you're in China, I'm curious just, you know, from your time there and speaking to people, maybe like the media coverage around you, how does the average Chinese person, at least, I mean, I can't know you can't speak for all of China. It's a very large country with a lot of people. But in your experience, how does the average Chinese person view the issue of Taiwan, for example? Because I assume that, you know, Chinese people generally want Taiwan reintegrated into China. It's a part of China. But, you know, in the US, we hear this constant like fear mongering about, oh, my God, China is going to invade Taiwan and like militarily crush it. So is that even something that's talked about in China, this military option that we constantly hear about in the US? And, you know, is Taiwan even on the national news agenda like the way it is in the U.S.? Because it dominates so much of our attention here. Or I'm not here, but you know what I mean. I'm in Lebanon, but
in the media space of the U.S. I mean, you're not in the U.S., but the U.S. stays in you.
Yeah, the U.S. stays. Yeah, you can get out of the U.S., but get out of my mind. You can't get the U.S. Exactly. I'm a colonized mind.
Yeah, no. That's deep. I mean, I think, I won't pretend to speak for every 1.4 billion people, but I mean, on the whole, never, too much pressure. I can barely speak for me. No, but I mean, I think one thing, average Chinese person, I would say, like, it's pretty unanimous, is that Taiwan and the fact that it hasn't reunited with the mainland is still a symbol of, you know, this long legacy of, you know, colonialism and imperialism, and this, you know, what's called the century of humiliation at the hands of, you know, first European powers, but Japanese imperialism. And so that, I think, you know, every average Chinese person will want to see a united China with Taiwan. But I would say everyone would want to see that happen peacefully. So yes, Taiwan is on a big, you know, as a big item, agenda point, and people feel it very dearly in their hearts. And also, it's part of a national strategy in terms of, you know, the goal towards the national rejuvenation is also the, you know, reunification of the country. But I wouldn't, in terms of the hype of the Western media, it's not like walking around, there's this expectation of, you know, the Chinese PLA troops landing on the island to take it back at any point. You know, that's not the sentiment. I mean, people want this to be a peaceful integration. People are not, you know, and I was actually talking to a friend earlier today, and she's like, well, this is just not part of the Chinese logic to think that, oh, conquering or like, you know, defeating through military force is the way of the Chinese. I mean, just look at the history of how China has dealt with international relations. It's not the way. Military is not the first option pretty much ever. So just to say, I mean, but of course, I think I could say that most vast majority of people want a reunited China.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of times it's projection too, like, especially when it comes to US media, the first thought on most people's minds is a military option. So it's like this projection of just assuming like every other country's leadership thinks the same way. And that's a really important aspect of all of this. And it's, I mean, it's just, again, I don't know like how the media framing is on international issues in China. I don't know if it's driven. I imagine that to some degree it's driven by what's happening internationally. For example, like with the AUKUS situation, which is a really aggressive maneuver by the US, Australia, UK, and then France got all upset because they were left out.
And then just allies, right?
Exactly. And then this constant, you know, it's less now, so I think maybe because it didn't work, but the sort of constant demonization of China over the issue of Xinjiang. I don't know, like how are those things perceived in China? Like, is that even really registering with people, or is that more something that Americans are being constantly like badgered with it through the media?
I mean, I think there's AUKUS, there's a Quad, there's definitely an encirclement strategy happening, and obviously seeing Taiwan as part of this, you know, US's long arm jurisdiction that it exercises unilaterally over many parts of the world, and also sanctions on the, you know, the media, misinformation campaigns and all that. So I think Chinese people are pretty aware of these maneuverings and what this is trying to do. At the same time, I mean, still trying in the best capacities to kind of put out a message of cooperation, multilateralism, you know, constructing instead of just destroying possibilities, you know, whether it's through the SEO, whether it's through the Belt and Road Initiative, whether it's through cooperation on climate. I mean, these are things that, you know, that's, I guess, in a way, the response to this kind of encirclement. And there's also, you know, looking at Taiwan again, you know, this long history of colonialism, imperialism, and how certain parts of, you know, the country have been used for imperialist interests. People are seeing that also in terms of carry on and a legacy or continuation of that history, right? So it's not a new kind of surprise of how the tactics are worked. It's just maybe in different forms today.
And I guess lastly, just on the issue of the sort of Chinese perspective towards the US, I mean, obviously, we know because of this endless stream of propaganda in the West, a majority of Americans now support sending U.S. troops to, quote unquote, protect Taiwan from this supposed looming Chinese invasion that isn't going to happen. And many Americans now view China as one of America's biggest threats, which this is like relatively new. And this is literally just because of, obviously, the amount of U.S. propagandizing through the media against China. But, you know, to look at the other side of this, do the Chinese view the U.S. in the same sort of cartoonish and menacing way that the U.S. media and politicians are viewing China? Like, I imagine all this American hostility has to be provoking some sort of reaction there in terms of the way the Chinese view America.
I mean, I think definitely there's been a response in the sense of there's a few things happening. I think it has maybe broken any kind of disillusion that people might have had around the U.S., especially of this, you know, in the last 40 years of this opening up and reform and this reconciliation with the U.S. has meant there's a kind of romance in many ways with the U.S. that it was cultivated, and also an idealization of both the U.S. as an idea in terms of like what it represents culturally, but also in its way of life and system and everything like that. So in a way, there is a kind of awakening, I think, especially around young. It's really powerful of just like, okay, this is U.S., what it really is. And also linking back then, okay, this awakening of, oh, that's right, the history of imperialism that we've experienced always, and this is this again. And maybe I'll give an example of, I rarely go to see the movies, not because I support 996 work culture, but because I do work a lot, I rarely go to see the movies. 3-hour film. It was the third time I tried to see it, and finally I got the time to see it. It's called The Battle of Lake Changjin, which came out in this national holiday in October. National holiday hits are usually like the big blockbusters of the year. And it's about, I'll give you a little plot overview, but it's about the Chinese People's Volunteer Army that went to Korea during the Korean War to fight against U.S. imperialism. And Lake Changjin was one of the important battles where the Chinese volunteers directly fought the U.S. Army. It was probably, it's a historic film. Like, this kind of film wouldn't have been able to be made in a previous time. And I think it's just to respond to your question about what is this awakening in Chinese people and thinking about U.S. imperialism. So anyways, this film was huge, like $200 billion is going to be the biggest film ever, like in terms of box office in the history of Chinese cinema. It's already the biggest film of the year in the world. And I'll put it, long story short, it was 3 hours of watching Chinese people basically kick asses of U.S. military.
Not nice. Am I allowed to say that? I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean that. Not nice.
Imperialism, and you know, I don't think a film of that level has ever been made where actually challenging U.S. imperialism, U.S. militarism has been the focus of the film. And this is a massively popular film. I mean, you know, so this is, and we talk to people who, you know, follow this, like, the way the Korean War is also remembered now in the context of, you know, a revived U.S. imperialism in this region is a new thing. It is, in some ways, a response. And I would say that not only this awakening of anti-imperialism that we see now in mass media is that I mentioned with youth, is that there's also a growing, you know, for maybe one of the first times in a long time, a sense of Chinese confidence. Like, and that comes with, you know, cultural confidence. And we're seeing that, you know, now you'll see young people and they said, I don't want to buy Nike shoes, you know, where a previous generation would just been like done anything like to buy a pair of Nike shoes. That's all around the, you know, colonized world has always been like this, you
yes.
know, cultural U.S. cultural hegemony as well. Right. It's not 100%. Just that. Mm-hmm. And but now there's like these new brands, Li Ning, Anta, where like young people are like, I want to buy Chinese brands now, because I mean, not saying that consumerism is a representation of anything, but there is also an emerging sense of, you know, cultural pride of just being, yeah, I mean, when I grew up, it was like not cool to be Chinese, but now maybe it can be cool for young people to be Chinese. I think that's that awesome. In some ways is a response too, because there's a disillusionment with what the U.S. is doing and then kind of a look towards, okay, what can be what can we also be proud of as a kind of different model of relating to the world and also developing your own economy and well-being in people's lives?
No, I think that shouldn't be underestimated, that sort of cultural breaking through or, breaking down that U.S. hegemony that dominates everything to the point where
it's in the mind, like get out of
it. It colonizes your mind. It completely colonizes your mind. It's so important to dismantle that. I mean, in the country I'm sitting in Lebanon, like half the population is, I mean, it's the colonial mentality is so deep. It's like they want France to come occupy Lebanon. What you're talking about sounds amazing. I wish that it could exist in every third world country that's been dominated and colonized and had suffered under imperialism. And I think, one really important question that I think is really good to get on and maybe to even end on, it seems like these U.S. attempts to propagandize around these issues like Xinjiang and Taiwan and, other issues about China bad. It's not really working as well as they'd like it to, but we see more and more desperate attempts to sort of isolate China. Now it's, around the Beijing Olympics, where the U.S. Administration, the Biden administration, is talking about potentially boycotting the Beijing Olympics. I don't know how serious that is, but if they do that, that could be another way to diplomatically isolate China. So this demonization campaign is just never ending. So I guess my question for you is, do you think that the U.S. and China are on just an inevitable collision course? And why is that so dangerous, if it's true?
I mean, I think the Olympics just starting there. I was having this chat the other day. I met this senior editor from Scotland who's been living here for many years. So he's sort of seen the ebbs and flow of the Western media and how it sort of finds a lot of these attack points, and it's been happening for a while. So help me remember, it's okay. Not quite new. It's not that dire or something like that. But he was saying that the Olympics for him was kind of almost like a deja vu, in terms of like he remembers the Olympics from 2008 in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that he was witnessing how the media narratives were changing as the Olympics were approaching. He even said, he put it in this way of like, it was the biggest lie turned into truth that he ever saw in media at that point. And he's worked in media for a long time. And he was saying that, okay, so I don't remember who the journalist was and, what the study was, but what he told me was, at first there was a study to say that in the 10 years prior to the Olympics, there were 1.5 million people in Beijing that had been moved to new housing. Mm-hmm. So in a way you could look at it and say, oh, okay, that's cool. The city's built like an upgraded housing for 1.5 million people. Isn't that good? And then he said it started shifting to, oh, okay, 1.5 million people have been displaced to make way for the Olympics. And soon it was 1.5 million people were violently evicted because of, Olympics. Anyways, this is in a way we kind of how the media machine works in creating new demons out of, obviously big bad China as always. Mm-hmm. But I think that was a useful memory. It's like, okay, what we're seeing now has happened before, and then, it will continue. But I think there is some dangers. I don't know if it's, an inevitable collision course, because ultimately U.S. is also not also one entity on its own, There are many interests and have extremely, this whole delinking process has really not worked in the favor of the U.S. economy, the U.S. Right. working class. And so there's kind of finite possibility of, let's hope, of this kind of demonization campaign. But I think there is, risks in terms of, setting the narrative, which the U.S. really does dominate, and what the rest of the world gets to know about China. And, that's a danger. I mean, the kind of level of increasing ignorance, that is pretty much encouraged and perpetrated through the media means that that's not going to help. People actually need to know more about China and what's really happening, not mediating through that lens of basically fake news. Yeah. And I know that obviously, any listeners here in Breakthrough are already seeking that kind of knowledge. And, Breakthrough News is one of the great places we can go to cut through the crap of mainstream media. Yeah. But I mean, one thing I guess I would do a little, you know, advertising, if I can. But yes, I mean, of course. For anyone interested in learning more about China and the day-to-day news, the collective I'm part of called Dongsheng, I really immersed, like we came together, just an international group of people from around Latin America, Africa, Asia, and North America that wanted to say, okay, we want to cut through a little bit of the Western media and the middleman, you know, and get to learn more about what's happening in China, Chinese politics, Chinese society, what Chinese people think, you know. And so this is really one of the parts where I would almost say like the dangers are of that ignorance of not having the adequate knowledge to make the judgments and to kind of perpetrate the China bad narrative without adequate information. So we try to do a couple of things, which is there's like a weekly digest we do of just news, the top 10 news headlines. So it's like, yeah, politics, like we'll talk about this movie that I just mentioned, or like, you know, geopolitics, AUKUS, whatever. But then there's another one we do on Sundays, which is also bringing like the debates of China from the intellectuals and academics, but also journalists, because there's always a thinking that, you know, in China, there's no debate. There's no like conversations people have about all these topics we went through. Like there's a huge amount of debate that happens here. And so we're trying to bring that just to see, okay, we might not agree with all the thought, you know, the perspectives, but the point is that there is debate, whether it's what's the future of climate change? How do we shift from a coal-based economy to a green economy? How do we deal with questions like Taiwan or whatever? That's there, you know? So I invite people to also try to, you know, to kind of avert this collision course is also arm ourselves with a bit more knowledge.
Yeah, that's really important that you mentioned that. And I subscribe to the Dongsheng News Collective. So I get those Sunday newsletters that have so much incredible information about like what those conversations that you're talking about. So I encourage everybody to do that. Tings, one last thing. Where can everyone follow your work?
Well, you can follow at Dongsheng News. But also you can follow me on Twitter. I'm more active now. I've learned some Twitter ways. And I'm on Instagram as well. So you can find my name, Tings Chak. You'll probably find me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again to break all this down.
Thank you, Rania. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.